You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, December 29th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape, just steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's a best-of show. So we're starting to wind down 2014, ladies and gentlemen. So it's a repeat. Today on the program, my interview from January of 2014 with Professor David J. Blacker on his book, The Falling Rate of Learning and the Neoliberal Endgame. Why this interview? Now, you should know the next 5 days we're going to be doing best ofs. And in the middle of the week, we have Professor Walter Block. That's a different story. But the other four of these interviews, we chose them both because they were recommended by people and because it hit four different quadrants of things that we talked about in 2014. I think that are going to be important going into 2015. And one of them is both. The interview with David Blacker combines two things that interest me both in 2014 and will interest me in 2015. That is education and neoliberalism. And if you like either of these topics, we got some great interviews from 2014. Barbara Maldaloni, the new head of the Massachusetts Teachers Union, did a great interview with her in 2014. You should check that out. We spoke to Alfie Cohn about education. We spoke to Kristen Burris about the neoliberalism that attacked essentially New Orleans in the wake of Hurricane Katrina and how it affected those schools. And if you're interested in neoliberalism as an idea, check out Philip Murawski's interview that we did in June of this year and Henry Giroux in April of this year. All of those were in the running, but we figured we could roll them all up into one in some ways with this interview with David Blacker. So I hope you had a good holiday, and I hope you're looking forward to New Year's right now. I am still with in-laws. I imagine now that I could barely button my pants, and both because of the girth of my stomach and the shakiness of my hands. From being subjected to what I've just been subjected to. So with that said, here's an interview with David J. Blacker. And then all this week, Matt has pieced together different segments that from our better half. So if you're not a member of the program, this is what you missed, just a taste of what you missed in 2014. A lot of Michael's impressions, a lot of Matt's impressions of Michael's impressions, a lot of of bits and riffing on stuff over the and some phone calls and some jousting with some libertarians all this week. So later this week, you'll hear from other best ofs. But for now, here is David J. Blacker, and we'll be back tomorrow with another best of.
You sleep the west, on the wood of east, is a
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, professor of the philosophy of education and legal studies at the University of Delaware, and the author. His latest is The Falling Rate of Learning and the Neoliberal Endgame. He's joining us at the moment from Cairo. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Hi, Sam. Glad to be here.
So let's start with the state of education in this country and how we perceive how we perceive education and how that's changed over the years.
Well, I guess from my analysis is that over the years, we've perceived education as, one consistent theme has been as vocational preparation, right? So we're adding value to future laborers, to the workforce, in order to, supply enterprises of various kinds. And education has been thought of in that respect. There's also other agendas. There's a citizenship agenda that's been advocated a lot. There's earlier agendas too, depending on how far you want to go back. So, for example, I think the earliest one could say the earliest impulse toward public education in colonial times, even before the United States, was a religious impulse. In fact, one of my favorite education laws it comes by the wonderful title of Ye Old Deluder Satan Act from 1647 in Massachusetts, which required towns of over 50 families, I think it was, to set up a primary school to teach literacy on the theory that these were Puritans, Protestants, et cetera, on the theory that in order to be saved, you had to be able to read the Bible by your own lights, by yourself. And not with help from a priest or so on. So there's this imperative kind of toward universal education that everyone needs to get it. So it's not all, the capitalism and so on. There are pre-capitalist, you might say, imperatives. So there are religious imperatives, citizenship imperatives, especially in the 19th century when things get going. But I think what really, really motors the imperative toward universal public education in the form that we now have it is starting in the late 18th century, 19th century, especially the need to create workers in various ways that have certain skills associated with literacy and also, aspects of behavior, habit formation and so on that are sometimes referred to as a hidden curriculum, stuff that you get from school that isn't part of the formal lesson, but that you're still learning, like sitting still for a long period of time, having kids become accustomed. And I know you have small children, right? So this is, you maybe appreciate how big this one is, being accustomed to sitting still, and having your movements regulated by a clock, taking directions from a manager / teacher, in schools that, and also things like, and in the 19th century, it's really amusing to read some of this stuff, how challenging this was. Things like showing up to work sober, was a big issue, apparently. things that we, somewhat take for granted, some of us, were part of a kind of hidden curriculum that really gave impetus to the drive toward universal public education in the 19th century, roughly you could say, universal primary education around the middle of the 19th century, and then at the cusp of the 20th century, extending that up to secondary education.
And so now, and when you talk about the falling rate of learning, just describe for us what that phrase means, and then we will sort of explain why you perceive this to be happening.
Yeah, and what I wanted to do is there are a lot of critiques of education, from the right, from the left, from the center, from perspectives that are hard to describe where they're coming from. but plenty, let's say, from the left, critiques of marketization and neoliberal imperatives and so on. And, for example, Diane Ravitch, right, who you've had as a guest, and her Reign of Error and other works by her, just, you know, very much along those lines. And I'm, you know, I guess in an academic division of labor, I've been informed by those critiques and influenced by them. But what I wanted to do was try to get a sense of why, you know, why is this stuff happening? And for better or worse, my background is philosophy. So I have this sort of disease of wanting to keep pushing why questions until everyone leaves the room by myself, you know. Wanting to why? Well, why? What's the sort of large story for why this is happening? And, you know, casting around, especially after the financial crisis, 07, 08, sort of my attempt to understand what the heck's going on in education tied up with what's the heck's going on in the economy. I found the most compelling explanation, or at least a large part of the most compelling explanation for me, had to do with changes in the nature of capitalist production itself, sort of tectonic shifts at a sort of deep level, large scale structural shifts. Otherwise, I feel like in education, when we get to education, we're just kind of treating symptoms and we don't really have a sense of, you know, why things are happening. So anyway, now, casting around, the title of my book, Falling Rate of Learning, is from the Marxist theory, The Falling Rate of Profit, which has a lot of doubters out there, including on the left. It's not even really a popular theory on the left anymore, but I think recent events have ought to give it a greater impetus. And with the help of economists like Andrew Kleiman, for example, who I think does really interesting work on this and provide as an economist. Provides interesting data and so on. The falling rate of profit theory, I guess we need to be in a really tight nutshell here, is that due to, and this is in Marx's third volume of Capital, for those who want to
open their home, right?
yeah exactly, and open up their hymnal books and you know, read along chapter and verse. The basic idea is that due to changes in production, most notably automation, technology, and so on, profits, the competition drives, capitalist competition drives increasing automation, increasing, you could say, technolization of the workforce. And now the Marxists get into all kinds of technical detail about the formulae, how capital is accumulated, and the proportion of what they call variable capital, that's human capital, like the labor, and that's where education comes in, and to the fixed capital, which is all the stuff, you know, the equipment, the shop, factory floor, the machine tools, all that kind of stuff. Those ratios change, but basically as productivity is augmented by especially technological means, there's less and less profitability in the system because other firms catch on and start employing the same productivity, the same technologies, the same efficiencies. Now, in the best case, it's sort of the great advertisement for capitalist production, right? It's a win-win. We all get iPhones that keep getting better and better, allegedly. And you know, that story. But in the long run, in the very long run, and this is Marx's view in Capital, the volume 3 of Capital, it becomes harder and harder essentially for sort of quote-unquote normal capitalist firms in quote-unquote conditions of normal competition to turn a profit. Because
let me just stop here just to sort of tease this out. So long-term trends are such that you have factories or production relies more on technology, but that
and less on human labor
and less on human labor, and the reliance on that technology has diminishing returns because their competitors also adopt these technologies, and so the profits are just less and less over time.
Right, because as per theories of labor value that could be debated but probably are beyond our scope right now, the real profitability comes from the human part of the equation, the exploitation of human labor. And that starts to become less and less of a percentage, less and less of a factor in profits. You know, when I looked at education, and I think the sort of traditional leftist critique of education, Marxists and fellow travelers and others, is that, you know, the problem with modern education, contemporary education, is that it's exploitative. You know, it's overly vocational, you know, and other goals like citizenship education. And even if you're of a religious type, you know, those kinds of goals are swept to the side and everyone's focused on the vocational sort of product. So it's exploitative. And so it's just sort of part of being a member of a productive capitalist enterprise. You know, it's just an early start toward making yourself marketable and valuable to some firm. So it's exploitation.
And we should say that it's basically to get an education just to tee you up so that you have the skills to go and work, as opposed to enhancing you knowledge for knowledge sake, or enhancing your knowledge for the sake of being a good citizen or a good person.
Oh yeah, yeah. Forget about that stuff. Yeah, yeah. I mean, at best, those are just kind of incidental products that are maybe nice, or maybe reserved for elites, right? But the real thing is to add value to capitalist production. And so it's exploitation. And the traditional leftist critique, I think, is drawing on Kant. You know, I'm a philosopher, so I have to drop these names. The idea that it's sort of almost an insult to our humanity because we're being treated as means to an end, almost sort of like slaves in a way. You know, we're not being viewed in our full humanity. We're just being viewed as potential drones, you know, in some profit accumulating enterprise. So,
and in a more grounded critique would be the sort of the corporate reform movement of education is trying to sort of bottom line all this and to measure the value of an education within the context of sort of a corporate structure.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, identify different kinds of efficiencies and increasingly sort us in more efficient, streamlined ways and to sort of deploy us in ways that maximize efficiency. Now, my critique here, what is perhaps something of a departure in my critique, is I say that's the good old days, you know, as sort of, you know, dismal as that sounds. And I was inspired, or I guess, you know, I've often been accused of a certain type of pessimism. A friend of mine called it invigorating pessimism, and I hope that's what it is. But my more pessimistic view, I was inspired by, if inspired is the right word, anyway, by a phrase from an English economist, Joan Robinson. I think it was in the 50s. She said, well, you know, we've learned that the only thing worse than being exploited by the capitalist is not being exploited by them. You know, and so being exploited, being almost the golden era, what I call the all hands on deck era of capitalism, where the more labor, the better. Immigrants, get them in here. You know, more hands on deck, more exploitation, that creates more profits, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I think due to these changes that we mentioned a little while ago, and having to do with productivity through automation and ultimately the changing nature of capital itself, we're entering an era of what I very dismally call eliminationism, where the mass of humanity simply isn't required as much anymore for profitability for these enterprises, and so that's bound to reflect itself in our educational systems. Whereas once and that very ideal of universal education I see is threatened now, because you know I see it as, in general, not exclusively, it's more complicated than that, and I don't embrace a wholly reductionist picture. But in general, it's that that imperative toward universal education is really, I think, driven in our experience in this country, has been driven by this idea of exploitability, maximizing the ability of the most people we can get to be exploited by capitalist enterprises. But now I think we're in a situation where simply less people are needed. So in the economy.
So let's back up just a little bit here. So when we talk about this concept of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, we can see that reflected at least in our society in the increase in financialization of our economy, as opposed to sort of an economy that is based on producing actual things.
Yeah, exactly. And we know, I mean, we can get an economist to give us the stats, but we know that that's where the profits are these days, right? It's in the casino. It's in the financialization end of things. And what I think, what's interesting and I think often missed about this falling rate of profit, because a lot of profit corporations at the moment are profitable. You know, so they say, oh, where's your profitability declining thesis? Because there are corporations that are profitable. I think, and actually Marx saw this. And again, I'm not one to just, my goal isn't to defend Marx, but I'll give him credit where credit's due, is that we see the tendency of the rate of profit to fall not so much directly, I think, but we see it in a symptomatology, what Marx actually called counterforces, that we see across a range of fronts, including financialization being just one of those, but globalization itself, also just plain increasing rates of exploitation, kind of work speed ups and so on. And ultimately, I think neoliberalization itself is a symptom of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, where there's this almost desperation to make up for this lack of profitability in our grandfather's capitalism, the good old competitive capitalism. And so the features of the world we see today that are sometimes conveniently labeled as, neoliberalization are all counterforces that are brought about by the resistance attempting to resist this downward kind of sink on profitability.
So these are all, when we talk about neoliberalization, when we talk about globalization, when we talk about financialization, these are all responses to the phenomena of this of profit lowering in a the rate of profit decreasing, we should say, in localities, I guess, and in more productive activities.
Yeah.
And
right, and just in productive competitive capitalism. So and even in the financialization area, we decreasingly see investments in any meaningful sense. Where the idea is you're investing in productive enterprises. It's more just betting, really.
Right.
Right.
And in the same way, if we were to sort of take that dynamic that the rise of neoliberal economics, the rise of globalization, and of course technology has allowed us to do a lot of this, and the rise of financialization also sort of abetted by technology, but the impetus to turn to those, to head down those paths, I guess, is a function of the lack of profits or the lack of increasing profits in the sort of world, the capitalism that we knew. And in some ways, the corporate reform movement that we see within education as a response sort of parallels that same sort of dynamic, right?
Exactly. So I think, education by and large, and there are islands of autonomy, and I wrote a really long book about that before this one, about institutional autonomy. There are ways education can depart sometimes, but by and large, I think the education system of society services the economic system, so that's what we have. And so it's no surprise, maybe with a little lag time and so on, especially in the rhetoric, it's not surprising that we would see these developments reflected in the education system. And I see kind of the various sort of assaults on education, including on public education that we see currently, as reflective ultimately of this process. So, if there's less need to for so many people to exploit in the economy, I think it's reasonable to predict that we're going to see less enthusiasm among elites for the very project of universal education.
Now that comes in the form of two things. One, see a less of a public investment in education. We see it on a higher education level. This is borne out by statistics.
Yes. So we have austerity for one. Yeah. For starters, austerity. Yeah.
And we can see that in the form of less funding for higher education by states and by the federal government, and sort of shifting to a sort of a loan based type of support for higher education, as opposed to simply providing it and paying for it directly. We see it.
So it's on to the individuals. It's on to the individuals rather than state support in higher ed. Yeah, exactly.
And that dynamic also is a function of this notion that you must now calculate the worth of an education in very narrow terms. In other words, a college education is only worthwhile if it provides you X times return on your investment.
Yeah, it's you know the game of life. You remember that game, the board game of life? You know, when you play that game, you got to make that calculation. Do you want to go to college? You know, do you want to have kids? I try to stay out of college and not have kids in that game. Actually, you know, I feel like you turn out ahead, but you have to make these calculations. It's a pure personal investment, and you're predicting the future returns on that investment. And you know, universities are only, including my own and all others, are only too happy to trot out statistics about how you'll earn more over the lifetime, you know, with a college education than you would with a high school education and so on. On one level, it becomes this purely personal investment. Whereas in previous generations, and again, I'm not one to hearken to some golden era, but I think there was a little more sort of holistic rhetoric. Say in the 19th century, when we were setting up land grant universities, there was a pretty robust sense of the public good.
Even when you look at it in terms as crass as Henry Ford, right? That, I want to pay and invest in my workers because they're going to drive my business. That dynamic has sort of broken down.
Yeah, kind of an enlightened egocentrism. You know, we don't get the enlightened part so much from our elites these days. And you know, those land grant colleges, the sense that if I'm a farmer, you know, out in wherever, and I live on a farm, I kind of get this. Why should I care about what's going on at the state university? Well, it's because these bright young fellows from the agricultural extension show me some cool stuff about fertilizer. You know, to help me, become more productive, and you know, it seemed worthwhile. Like there was a sense that we're kind of all in it, that mm-hmm. we all benefit from an enlightened populace. And there's also enduring Jeffersonian ideals of an enlightened citizenry that you need for a democracy. But you know, when it comes down to it, I think that economic kick is really what does it. But I think these days there's a decreasing sense that a general diffusion of knowledge among the population, say through higher education, and there's questions about how much knowledge is being diffused among today's undergrads, say, but a general diffusion is there's a decreasing sense that that actually benefits the public as a whole rather than benefits A, elites, I think, specifically, and B, just those individuals themselves, you know, so right. It's harder to make an argument to that farmer for why he should or she should pay taxes, you know, to support the local state university in order to support this kid who's going to be the sole beneficiary of the credential rewards that kid is receiving. So it's kind of a more crabbed sort of vision. It becomes just another commodity.
How do we see that credentialism or that commodification in the context of elementary school and junior high and high school? I mean, how does it manifest itself there?
Well, I guess what I see, and you know, my general thesis here is that, I mean, I think what we see is a general waning in the commitment to this whole project of universal education itself. And so if we're talking about K through 12 schools, we see it reflected in, along several fronts. One, kind of we talked about before, austerity, I suppose, just kind of it's always a budget squeeze, you know, always a budget squeeze. It's always doing more with less. And that's kind of what we have. We also see, and I have a chapter that deals with this just because I happen to know something about it. I think so. We see a decreasing patience with students' rights and students' expression, as reflected in some recent Supreme Court decisions and a general sort of societal mood that. You know, these kinds of things are less important because they speak to development of the whole person and sort of, you know, proto-citizens, you know, exercising free speech in schools. The purpose there is that they're going to become citizens. And if we want citizens to be able to robustly exercise free speech, they need at least a little of that in schools. And so I think we see, you know, due to certain legal developments and also some of the terrorism stuff feeds into this safety, you know, concerns. We see a decreasing patience with student expression in different ways. Also, I think we see a willingness to kind of compromise when it comes to things like compulsory education. But in some ways, I think you could argue the biggest thing is that I think increasingly we see a kind of disciplinary environment in schools, you know, where many schools, especially in certain areas, seem to be much more designed for surveillance and warehousing and, you know, the so-called school to prison pipeline and all that stuff. I think it's that, you know, so my argument is not that the schools go away, that they get eliminated, you know, the buildings are there and they're still called schools, but I think their nature starts to change underneath everyone's feet.
And we see that also in the way that the ability for teachers to develop their own curriculum becomes narrowed so that they are doing something that is very specific and supposed to have the most value to society as making, you know, it's almost as if the sort of and I keep hearkening back to this a little bit, but this corporate reform movement is to squeeze the last value out of a diminishing number of students and a narrow value out of them.
Right. And along with that, just adding fuel to that same fire would be privatization across the board, which we see especially in higher ed, but now sort of coming to a public school near you, you know, a public K-12 school near you.
I think we have like 20 times the amount of charter schools in this city in New York than we did at the beginning of the Bloomberg administration.
Yeah, Delaware, where I teach, is big on those too. And of course, that's all premised on a kind of invisible hand model. You know, it works so well for the banking industry. Surely it'll work well for the school system.
And so let's get into that theory of eliminationist. I mean, tell us what that means, and then within this context.
Well, eliminationism is, you know, I mean that it's somewhat of a hyperbolic, because I'm trying to kind of shake people by the scruff of their neck, you know, and pay attention. It's drawn from a very dark context, which is the context of Holocaust scholarship and historians like Daniel Jonah Goldhagen, who, you know, analyzing the Nazi hierarchy and their debates over the quote unquote Jewish problem, you know, at the Wannsee conference and so on, there were the, you know, this also, by the way, gives you an illustration of how parameters of discourse can be quite narrow to the vanishing point, where the sort of progressive side wanted to work people to death, right? And the other side wanted to simply send you straight to a death camp, you know, without the exploitative moment. And so of course, that's, you know, an extreme. And I'm not saying our schools are Treblinka, you know. But I think the structural sort of moral logic is similar, where we've moved from exploitation to this posture of elimination with regard to our own, you know, young citizens, because they're no longer needed in the same way.
And they're no longer needed as to be educated in many respects, right? I mean, it's the ideal of an educated population that is being eliminated, less so than the actual population.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, and that has ramifications for democracy and the sustainability of a democracy and so on. But, you know, in the 90s, there Robert Reich, his book, I forget the title of it, the vision was this kind of sunny vision of we'll all be knowledge workers and doing all this creative stuff. And the answer is more education, you know, more education. Well, I'll tell you, I think that's true for a tiny, tiny sliver, you know, the people who get the good jobs at Google maybe or whatever. But, you know, compare Google to River Rouge and the numbers employed. But, you know, that's available for a time. For most of the population, I think a dirty little secret about technology and education, you know, where the assumption seems to be that the more technologized the society are, the higher educational demands are, and the more we need educated workforce. Well, I think very often it's the opposite. You know, a simple example would be, when I was a kid, we had cash register. When I had like a fast food job, we had cash registers where you had to like count change back to people, you know, and stuff, and actually do a little math. Right. Now the cash registers, that they dispense the change automatically, and they're high, much more high tech, but they require less skill. You know, change is dispensed less skill and nudge. Change is dispensed automatically. I think you don't even have to know when to stop when you pour the medium-sized Coke. You know, you just press the icon, you know, right. And it does it for you. So there are all these areas where, you know, it's sort of a fallacy, I think, to think that the higher tech society requires higher levels of education. I think that's true for just a shrinking sort of sliver of sort of a managerial class that's becoming fewer and fewer, where the rest of us are. Well, I guess I'm a professor in a university. Maybe I'm part of that sliver, you know, vanishing sliver, but where most all of us are then condemned to a situation in which those, you know, any skills we might have are simply irrelevant. We're just kind of like wards of the state, just not even really needed anymore.
So what is that neoliberal endgame then?
First of all, I guess I want to clarify. For me, neoliberalism actually doesn't exist. You know, it's more of a rhetoric. It's sort of like capitalism's PR department, you know, because it's more of a rhetoric. I mean, so I actually think neoliberalism is simply a kind of rhetorical justification for what's going on. So, for example, with neoliberal rhetoric across the board in education and other areas, we have a huge, you know, like obeisance to competition. You know, competition, got to get more competitive, and markets. We got to have more markets. Everything's got to be marketized. However, I think behind the scenes of that, what's really going on, the elites are sitting back and they're in monopoly positions where they're essentially rent collecting. You know, so competition is for the little people, right? And, you know, we have too big to fail banks. We have, you know, everyone, you know, the elites are consolidating themselves into monopoly positions and using this sort of rhetorical club of neoliberalism for those who still sadly believe in things like competition and marketization, and you know that's the way to go. So first of all, I think neoliberalism is kind of this fictional sort of rhetoric. Like I said, it's sort of like the Madison Avenue of today's capitalist class, I think. You know, too bad for us if we continue believing in it. Because paradoxically, in this so-called neoliberal era of competition, we're getting more and more monopoly. You know, that's where the money is. And that's where the political power is. So I guess I'd say that first. And so to me, the end game has to do with, societal collapse, because, you know, due to factors we haven't talked about, yet, there are internal tensions, I think. I don't think this system is economically sustainable, because of these internal, sort of tensions having to do with profitability, but I also think there are externalities having to do with the environment, you know, and also potentially energy, what's sometimes called energy descent and resource depletion across the board. These sort of externalities, you know, the external factors that are needed for the production, the energy factors, and also the externalities in the sense of the effects, you know, like on pollution, climate change, you know, et cetera. These things don't tend to get factored in to sort of neoclassical economic models. And so run this whole machine forward. And I think there are three sort of distinctive, I've taken to calling them the three horses of the apocalypse. You know, the economic, you know, the economic tensions, climate change, and then the energy problems, and resource depletion problems. And so we're kind of sitting here captive watching this really unpleasant horse race. You know, any one of those horses will be quite sufficient to do us in. And I grew up in Kentucky, and the horse races were a lot more fun there than that one.
Well, yeah. So I mean, so you've got these three horses of the apocalypse, and they're not, but they're not necessarily directly related to learning. I mean, the learning is in some ways,
they're not. Except
the fall in learning is symptomatic of what of a problem that is in some ways, I guess, explained by the other by the three horses.
Yeah, they're symptomatic, and I think the education system doesn't have a lot of agency. I think educators, naturally so, kind of like to, you know, puff themselves up and sort of a little cheerleading, understandably so, to feel that they have a lot of agency. You know, you can do it, you can pull yourself up, we can change the world through better education, and so on and so forth. But I think that's all illusory. You know, I think there's not a lot of agency there. You know, it might be good for individuals who might scramble on the lifeboats that are getting smaller and smaller, you know, by education. So if I want my own kids to maybe try to get on that lifeboat and beat the other people off of it, I guess. I don't know. But I think overall the education system isn't really a motive force here. I don't think it has. I think it's more of a kind of marionette of these larger forces. Like, so for example, and not just the economic forces, like if we look at, you know, energy, for example, in the United States, especially, our whole school system is set up on the assumption of cheap oil, cheap energy, right? We have these large sort of catchment areas that are, we run by, where we get kids to school by bus transport, you know, to factory schools. We have buildings that are only inhabitable with HVAC systems, you know, that require, you know, a lot of expenditure and sort of assume cheap energy, like multi-floor school buildings in Houston, where I also grew up, and in places like Miami. And they're simply not habitable. So I think even the structure of the institutional sort of forms of schooling in this country are sort of, you know, right on the edge in various ways that aren't always appreciated.
So we don't have too much time left, but let's get to the invigorative part of the pessimism. So where does that leave us? I mean, if this is the road that we are headed down, and what we're seeing, this fight, let's say, in the education sphere between sort of corporate reformers and those who want to maintain education as something that should educate, you know, the person for a broader set of reasons than just to function, to be exploited, and it's still in some ways holding on to the notion that they all can be exploited rather than just sort of like, we're going to pick out a few of you to be exploited.
Happy vision is universal exploitation. Let's get back to that.
Right.
That
I mean, yeah. So where does that leave us? I mean, do we need to, I mean, I think you talk a little bit about sort of on some level, it's about biding our time until the playing field changes because one of those horses of the apocalypse shows up and changes the playing field.
Yeah, and I think our best I think our best chance is, you know, Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, right, where it sort of sees the crisis. The right wing tends to seize the crisis. I think, you know, we maybe a little progressive or left wing shock doctrine thinking is in order. Frankly, opportunistic thinking, because I don't think the good guys are going to win in terms of school reform and all that. I think that system is fated to go down. I mean, there's some nice rhetoric. There's some nice oppositional types that I, you know, their parts are in the right places. But I think that system's going down. And so, to me, I think the invigorating part, and my last chapter.
I was going to say, incidentally, this is our last program.
We're going to just just wrap it up and, you know, wait on a beach somewhere.
Right.
My last chapter is entitled Fatalism, Pessimism, and Other Reasons for Hope. I mean, how about if we think about it this term? I think part of it, you know, because I'm focusing on educational institutions, and I think it's sort of target selection for the left, so to speak, right? I think it's really a waste of energy and a waste of time to put our hopes in the idea that we can reform schools, these institutions that we have as they're currently constituted. Because I think they're really fated. And I defend a certain notion of fate that I don't think means that things are foreordained in the future, but that certain institutions, just like certain individuals, can kind of be oriented in a certain direction. And it's right. Really, really hard to set them off course. But there's always chance. I mean, I guess let me end. If we're close to finishing, let me just say, I mean, think about, think about natural selection, right? I mean, a random mutation can occur. There can be unforeseen mutations that occur. There can be unforeseen environmental events that occur. And I think, you know, if history's any guide, there will be things that we don't see in the future that we can't predict. So I think, you know, if we extrapolate simply from present trends, that's where I don't see a heck of a lot of hope. I think we need something that's unanticipated at present to actually change course. And I would love, there's a really powerful tendency, and I get this all the time, especially from educators who like an activist, right? Activists, as the name suggests, they want to be active. You know, what can my agency do? What can my agency do? And if you're giving me a picture where there's no agency, then because it makes me feel bad psychologically, I'm going to reject that picture. Well, I think maybe that picture that we have itself could be the problem. You know, that we have this sense that we can always fix things through a kind of technological sort of fix. And I think, you know, oddly enough, paradoxically, there could be some sort of answer in our sort of letting go of that kind of assumption.
But, I mean, we should say that, you know, you say that from the perspective of a philosopher, you know, so, I mean,
yeah.
to be fair, but I mean, on some level, it also sort of says it's incumbent upon us to, be ready with prescriptions and to be opportunistic when the opportunity arises.
Yeah, exactly. So for example, small scale experiments in terms of pedagogy, I'm completely enthusiastic when I'm about those. So islands of progressive pedagogy and progressive schooling. I visited Summerhill School in England, which is sort of famously progressive school where students make the rules and so on. And I thought it was an absolutely wonderful, wonderful place. What I'm pessimistic about is the idea that these things are scalable, right? That they can be sort of the blueprint, the template for making over the whole system in general. That's what I want to throw cold water on and what I want to be pessimistic about. What I want though, I don't know if I'm pessimistic or not, but what I want is for those kinds of experiments to somehow just endure, you know, not on the hope that they're going to become the norm and they're going to scale, you know, everything according to themselves, but that they're going to be there lying in wait opportunistically, you know, in a shock doctrine sort of situation in which all of a sudden we're going to be looking around for different models because what we've been doing on this large scale simply is not possible anymore. And so it's going to be extremely valuable to have these models around. And I think the same thing about things outside education, sort of like, say, like permaculture.
Right.
In terms of, it's not that everything's going to become permaculture. Agribusiness is going to suddenly see the light and become, but I think, given the unsustainability of these modes of agriculture, these permaculture experiments, organics, and so on, these are going to be extremely valuable head starts to have around when they're really the only live options that we can turn to.
Well, Professor David Blacker, the book is The Falling Rate of Learning and the Neoliberal Endgame. Fascinating stuff. Invigoratingly pessimistic, but also again, just really fascinating, and really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, and it's important to keep a sense of humor. I should throw that in.
Indeed, we're just about to move into the funner half of the show.
All right, we'll
put a link to your book on majority.fm, and thanks so much for your time today. Really genuinely appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure, and keep up the great work. I love your show.
Oh, well, so. Thank you. All right, take care, folks. Bye-bye. All right, folks. Wow. I mean, fascinating stuff, and to a certain extent, I hope that at least some of that is wrong, but it is still incumbent upon us to fight the good fight and sort of push these ideas around. And, you know, it also reminds me of the conversation we had with Bhaskar Sunkara, who talked about socialist ideas being developed sort of in an intellectual realm, but in the meantime, working towards any type of incremental change simply because you are some change is better than no change, and you're developing relationships and spreading sort of ideas during that time. I mean, you know, I mean, it's incumbent upon me to say that so that we do show up tomorrow for work, and you continue to tune in. Oh, Jeez, what is wrong with you? We got an email from a European listener on what's going on in Ukraine.
That was a great email.
And then we also got an email from somebody who wasn't as thoughtful.
That was
well.
The
look, I have no problem with people criticizing Michael in emails. That is actually the least of the issue that I take with this email. But
when Sam gets critical emails, it's like a whole emotional crisis in the office.
No, that's not true. Yeah. I get critical emails all the time, but there is one thing that I don't like in an email. And in fact, maybe we should do this now.
Okay. There are several things I didn't particularly like.
Well,
about
I don't mind anybody slagging you. I mean, I think that seems in many respects very justified. But this is an email from a listener, George, a member. Michael, stop repeating Israeli propaganda. Michael claimed on the show that Hamas wanted Palestinians to be killed by Israel in order to garner support of their people. Almost identical to Israel envoy claiming Hamas celebrating the deaths of Palestinians. Very Nazi-like attitude. I am very disappointed. Now, let's take that part of the email first, okay? I don't think... No, you can't say, Michael. You're gonna stay out of this.
I think Michael is more Nazi than Nazi-like.
Yeah, I mean, I think this. Things are getting ugly in here. All right, look, Michael did not claim on the show that Hamas wanted Palestinians to be killed by Israel in order to garner support of their people. I don't think you claim that.
Not even remotely.
Okay. What Michael said, as far as I know, and I would agree with this assessment, or let me project onto what Michael said, and you tell me, Michael, if this is accurate, that in the same way that I believe Netanyahu and the Israeli government exploited the kidnapping of and killing of these three Israeli teenagers. In the same way that they held the information that they were probably dead and did not release the audio 911 footage of the boys being shot or the results of an investigation that found blood on the seats, which they clearly must have known were the kids, right? In the same way that they suppressed that information and used that as a pretext, and in the same way that the Israeli government uses Hamas's firing rockets or killing civilians as a means in which it allows them to build support domestically, Hamas does the same thing with the deaths of Palestinians. And anyone who thinks that Hamas is an organization to be applauded or praised, it must not be interested in the cessation of violence, nor the protection of Palestinian lives at this point. This is different from saying that they are responsible for it, et cetera, et cetera. And this is different from saying that the Israeli government doesn't deserve full responsibility for the deaths of Palestinian citizens. The reality is, and this is time to be grown-ups now, the reality is that these entities, whether it's the Israeli government, whether it's Hamas, more often than not act in the interest of their maintenance of power. Hamas was very weak before this started. Very weak. They were also not responsible, as far as I can tell, for the killing of these Israeli teenagers.
And I absolutely never said that.
Right, right. And yes, yeah. And Michael never said that. But, look, I think most people are aware of that. But now I'm talking the bigger issue. And so
you have to be an adult to absorb, I think, some of this material. There is no clean hands in this entire conflict, short of probably the Palestinian kids and civilians that have been killed and the Israeli citizens. Now, on one hand, look, there's certainly far more agency on the part of Israeli citizens or leverage on the part of Israeli citizens with their government than I think it is for your average Palestinian living in Gaza on Hamas. And so, you know, if we want to really bear down and you want to talk about culpability, that we could certainly make a broader argument. Now, and then, you know, if we're going to make that argument, we also have to include ourselves because our taxpayer dollars go to pay for a lot of this weaponry. But I will tell you this, that it's not identical to what the Israel envoy said. And it's also not very Nazi-like attitude. I don't even know what that means.
And I just said really briefly, I said there's an informal convergence of interest between Hamas and the right in Israel.
Of course.
Which is exactly the point.
Of course.
That of course they both benefit from situations like this. It's mind-blowingly
obvious. And it's quite clear that Hamas's political power has increased and Abbas's, the Fatah, has decreased.
His popularity in the West Bank has increased, not just in Gaza, because of this. Hamas has increased.
And that was not the situation 2 months ago. All right. The fact that you're very disappointed, okay, that's fine. If this issue is not addressed, I am canceling my membership. This is what I do in these situations, all right? One of the best things about this show, in my mind, is that I cannot be fired. And short of a bunch of members all deciding on one day that I don't want to be a member of this show, I don't want to support this show anymore, or because of financial reasons I can't support this show, the idea of people canceling their membership will not impact this show. Do not send me an email. You want to send me an email saying that I'm an idiot, I'm a moron, Michael's an idiot, a moron, Matt's an idiot, a moron. I mean, particularly if you want to say Michael is an idiot or a moron, that's fine. But when you attempt to leverage your membership over what we are saying on this show, I say to you, you're fired. You are fired. Your membership, you should go ahead and cancel it. Because I don't do that. You don't pay me enough to keep me quiet. And certainly I can tell you that my views on this in the past have had implications with my career. But that will not happen here. And so, and that's why I enjoy the show. So, yes, I've addressed the issue, but I think I have not addressed it in any way that you will ever be satisfied. Your membership is canceled. You're fired. Which I wanted to always to say, like, all right.
Mainstream media is beholden by the corporations, man. That's why I support alternative media. Now, you guys better fucking say what I want you to say.
Right, because... right. That's the thing. You could have written this. You could have written 3 pages of all the critique, and I would have been perfectly fine with it. But when you try and leverage your membership over something like that, you know, if you write me and say, you know what, your voice is really annoying, and I don't like your stutter. And use too many ums. Okay. And you cancel your membership? Okay, fine. If you don't take voice lessons, I'm going to cancel my membership. Okay. That's fine. But when you talk about saying, hey, I don't like your content. And even if you write to me and say, I've canceled my membership because you know what? I can no longer support this show. We had someone who
did that. Did that, yeah.
And I said, I wrote back. I said, look, I disagree with your points X, Y, and Z, but I perfectly understand that why you're canceling your membership. But when you try and leverage it, that to me, you know what you should do? You should go watch and go, watch the corporate media. Good luck with them. Because that's exactly what they do. All right, we're going to head into the better half of the program. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to be a part of the program, you can IM me at MajorityFM. And what else? Oh, become a member. We just lost one.
There's no cure for conservatism, but it can be treated by Dr. Sam Cedar. Sam Cedar is not an actual doctor.
As you know, Dr. Ben Carson is mulling over a 2016 presidential run because almost as a prerequisite to being a presidential 2016 candidate for the Republicans, you've got to be deluded and somewhat insane. And also seeking to enrich yourself on the deluded insane speaking tour that they all seem to go on. Here is Ben Carson. He is speaking at the Center for Security Policy's National Security Action Summit.
That's like something we would use in a screenplay.
That's right. And
it's like the Families for Families
that's
America.
Right. From the family. Now, why would Ben Carson be weighing in on the controversy in Colorado where students have walked out of classes because of a debate over AP history curriculums in Colorado? They want to change the curriculum of AP U.S. history materials to make sure that it promotes patriotism and doesn't encourage or condone civil disorder, social strife, or disregard of the law. Why would he be doing this at the Center for Security Policy's National Security Action Summit? Because of, don't you know, ladies and gentlemen, the problem with things like ISIS is because American children are not learning to be patriotic enough. And then just let's hear Ben Carson's twisted notion of what should be taught in American history.
And we need to look at our history, and we need to understand our history. You know, I am a little shocked, quite frankly, looking at the AP course in American history that's being taught in high schools across our country right now. There's only two paragraphs in there about George Washington. George Washington. Believe it or not. Little or nothing about Dr. Martin Luther King. A whole section on slavery and how evil we are. A whole section on Japanese internment camps and how we slaughtered millions of Japanese with our bombs. A whole section on how we wiped out American Indians with no mercy. I mean, I think most people, when they finish that course, they'd be ready to go sign up for ISIS. I mean, this is what we're doing to the young people in our nation. And, you know, we have...
What we're doing to the young people in our nation is actually teaching them the history. I'm not sure that he is refuting what we did to Native Americans or that slavery existed or that, yes, we dropped two quite large bombs and killed tens of thousands of Japanese women and children. And then we also did, in turn, Japanese
And also, he's lying about the barely mentions about Washington and Martin Luther King. But that's irrelevant. Continue.
Got to stop this silliness. We have got to stop, you know, crucifying ourselves. Have we made mistakes as a nation? Of course we have. Why? Because we're people. And all people make mistakes.
Like genocide and slavery.
That's right. Yes, all people make mistakes, like genocide, like enslaving a large portion of their population and building their country on the backs of those slaves and dropping atomic bombs on people. We're people. People make mistakes. Now, of course, one has to wonder, what would George Washington say in response to Ben Carson, if he was to come back and say,
"My, you are a well-spoken boy. When did your master allow you to speak in such a loquacious fashion?"
That's right.
And indeed, we all are people. Well, you, two-thirds of one.
Two-thirds of a person. But you, so-called doctor. Why, it's I, George Washington, just a people, a little bit more of a person than you, of course. Doctor, one wonders where you got that term
from. Dr. Girl, hello, Master Carson. Yes. Any of that sweet jambalaya stew that
I was going to ask you, did your master allow you to adopt the name Doctor? No need to bother yourselves about this little people mistake we made in terms of slavery.
If there were 40 like you, we might be pretty afraid. As a matter of fact, we might need to hang you right now.
Oh, my
so
goodness.
As you don't get
oh,
too,
well, let's not
too full
let's
of
not
your
remind
britches.
The children of what the little people mistakes we made. Now, I do believe it's time for you to run off now. You've had your time inside the house. It's time to get back out there and pick your cotton or do whatever you can to.
A little bit of honest labor never did two-thirds of a person any harm.
You're so well
Even you,
spoken.
You clever little doctor.
So I take it you must be a shaman, developing some type of tincture that your father told you about, your granddad told you about, bringing from Africa. Is that a... don't bother yourselves about this slavery. Yes.
Just sing us a song. Do you sing as well as you speak?
Oops. Who could have imagined? We made that bit of an oopsie. And don't, why, I am just absolutely shocked that they're not looking back on our time of slavery with anything but pride. Why, we founded this country. And the only way to do it in the way we were to do it was to get a significant amount of free labor. We should take pride in that. We were smart enough to realize that without paying people, we could have an economic boom.
Talk about resource maximization,
yes.
Dr. Galbraith.
Indeed. My goodness. It just breaks my heart to think that future generations wouldn't look back on that period with pride. And
am I not
to
right?
Look forward.
Am I not right,
goodness.
Doctor?
Can you imagine if we had the ability to drop that atom bomb as we were crossing the Delaware? Aside from not being able to live there for a certain period of time, everything would have been fine. Now then, run along.
Now,
fetch
run
my
along.
Slippers and my good tobacco. Unbelievable. You know, I should also remind Dr. Ben Carson that there was another guy who was very critical of things like slavery and the genocide of Native Americans, and was very critical of, well, let's say, the American role in Vietnam.
in the way that we treated all sorts of poor people. I think his name was something like...
there's a socialist named
Dr. Martin Luther King.
Yeah, that's Ben Carson. It concurrent. I love all these conservatives. It's unbelievable. Right. At the time, they would be... And they did.
Of course.
Demonize and do everything to destroy this man. And now it's like, oh, well, we've created this kind of Disney version of him that doesn't even match any type of actual history.
Apparently,
and
Dr.
That's
Martin
great.
Luther King
that guy's great.
Never talked about injustices
no,
like that.
No, he just came out and said, people should treat each other nice.
More patriotism. I remember that speech, and sadly, there's no audio of Dr. Martin Luther King when he came out and said, you know, if we don't stop bashing America, we're going to be turning people into radical jihadists. So. Lawyer Matthew, I can't understand Indy Mike's latest email, but I am sure he's not day drinking. And Lawyer Matthew says, you're the master of career-limiting moves. Thank you. I appreciate that. NAP, hi, I'm Veronica, 25, just bored, thought you might like this. Wait, what?
I think you should stop reading that
one. Are you getting spam?
Oh, my God.
Via IM. I hope you didn't click the link.
What
are you doing?
Was that a mistake?
Yes. Yes, definitely.
How do I block that guy? And it was a guy. And yes, he appears to be 25. Fully shaved.
Oh.
Jackson, 852. Here is a film to see. Burt's Buzz on Netflix. Burt's Buzz. Never heard of it.
You still talking about that?
Right. No kidding. M-Rex.
Sorry, it's James from the South.
From the South?
Yep, the South.
Okay. James from the South. Hi, James.
Of course it does. Are you serious? I'm not a liberal, a flaming liberal, so of course it's going to be promising.
Okay, so you're not a flaming liberal. What's up?
Oh, man, what isn't up in this world today? Let's talk about global warming, because I know you believe in global warming.
Okay. All right, people are very excited here. Okay, let's talk about global warming.
I'm always excited to talk to you. I've heard you on the radio for a while, well, on YouTube, let's say YouTube for a while, and I love your videos. It cracked me up, and it finally just hit that point where I got to call you and see if I can get on the air with you.
All right, well,
so
you're here, James.
Here.
All right, so you're James from the South, and you want to tell me that global warming is a hoax? Is that it?
Man-caused global warming, absolutely it's a hoax. Are you serious? There's no true... There's no scientific proven evidence that shows that man has caused global to warm up. I mean, there's no evidence to it. If you can prove me otherwise, I'd love to hear it, because you can't.
Well, I'm not a scientist, but it's not enough for you that that literally thousands of scientists, that virtually that every peer-reviewed study shows that global warming is real and that it's anthropomorphic or it's a man-made.
Cutting out on me real bad.
You're not. Are you not aware of the thousands of scientists and the hundreds of peer-reviewed studies that show that global warming is man-made? James?
We lost him.
No.
No. James? All right, James, please call back.
Call us right back, James.
Barry Code, who's this? All right, hang.
You
there?
Yes, James is back.
Okay.
I don't know what happened. I got cut off last time, but I called back.
All right, James, I appreciate it. So you were going to tell us. So, James, you've called in. You say you're from the South. You say that you've been watching the show on YouTube, and you just had to call in. What was it that made you call in? What was the last straw for you?
The last straw?
Yeah.
Oh, man, there's a ton of last straws, I'd say. Just the fact that you're such a liberal at times and you laugh at libertarians, and I'm a fellow libertarian, you know, and there's so many videos on there, and I feel bad for that one guy. The guy didn't want slavery. He said over and over again he didn't want slavery. Now, he was definitely wrong in what he said. and he doesn't understand libertarianism very well. But you cannot create slavery through libertarianism. You can't do that because you own your own body, and so you cannot have it be taken by anybody else. So that's your own willingness to give it up to someone. So that didn't work, but he didn't want it, so it was the wrong thing to put on your title. I got kind of excited. I wanted to see what this guy wanted. He didn't want libertarian, and you know, he didn't want that.
He didn't. Okay, I'm not 100% sure I'm following you here, but so what did you? Now you wanted to call in to refute the notion that global warming is man-made. Well, so let me ask you this: when you read about the IPCC report, this is where you've got literally thousands of scientists backed up by peer-reviewed studies who say that there's a 95 to 97% chance that global warming is a function of what humanity is doing, particularly since the Industrial Revolution. Why do you not take that as being real, or what is your perspective on that?
Because everything that we see is not changing, and they keep saying, and you just said it yourself, and this is what cracks me up, 95 or whatever percent chance, because they're showing all these models that say that, oh, well, if the CO2 levels, you know, go rising in our atmosphere, then the temperature is going to rise. Well, look, the CO2 levels have already risen, and there's no change in our temperature.
Well,
they
wait a second.
Hotter.
That's
actually,
not
it's
true
probably gotten colder.
Either. Like, eight of the hottest years on record have happened in the past, like, 10 or 15 years.
On record. Okay, this is, like, 200 years of record out of, like, tens of thousands. Not to mention, I'd actually like to see that record, because there is shown no evidence of the Earth getting hotter in the last 10 years.
So you don't believe... Wait a second. So let me just be clear here. You don't even believe that there's any global warming, not just that it's not man-made. You don't believe that global warming is happening.
As of right now, I don't know if I believe that global warming is even happening. I think there is a climate change going on, but I think the climate is always changing. I don't think there's ever a period where the climate doesn't change. I think it's constantly changing, because I think the Earth is actually a living thing it's constantly, you know, it's doing its own thing all the time. We just got out of a little ice age like a couple of thousand years ago. We're still, we've been warming up, you know, but it's going to cool back down. It's going to do the same thing. Canada was colder than Mars this year. That's a joke, right? Like, you think the Earth is warming up and it's colder than a planet that's further away from the sun.
When you talk about the planet, you got to sort of measure the planet. But let me ask you this. So this is not based on any reading of scientific studies or this and that. This is just sort of your gut feeling. Is that it or what?
No, there's plenty of scientists out there in the world that have gone on and on and on about how global warming is a bunch of bullshit and that this is just an Al Gore plot, you know. And now I see people being like, oh, well, Al Gore, you know, we're going to have to step away from him now because he's crazy. But global warming still is happening. No, it's not. And scientists are out there telling us that actually it's not happening.
Are there peer-reviewed studies that are telling us that? Are there peer-reviewed studies?
Absolutely there are. The problem is that you're looking at the UN scientists only. You're looking at these government scientists only. You need to look at the private scientists that are out there actually doing the real studies. Mm. Okay, they're proving that this is not happening.
I see. Okay.
Did you see the guys that went on the excursion in the boat to go see all the...
Let me just give you this figure.
Away?
There is one out of 9,136 recent peer-reviewed studies on the question of global warming, and one of them rejects the premise of global warming. So let me ask you this.
Just one
peer-reviewed, but I'm sure there's some plenty of individual private scientists, like the guys who work for the tobacco companies or something like that. But let me ask you this. I mean, you don't accept that, or you don't accept my numbers or whatever it is. You're just determined to believe that this is the case. What if their doctor came to you and said, look,
there's a 95% chance that you're going to die if you don't take this medicine or if you don't stop drinking. Would you say, like, well, that's just a 95% chance? I mean, how would you respond to it?
You know what? I would instantly start going to other doctors. And I would want to see, you know, because I'm not taking the opinion
of this
one
person. All right, fair enough. So you go to 9,136 doctors. 9,135 of them tell you there's a 95%.
You're missing the bigger picture.
What's the bigger
picture? You're missing the bigger picture here. You're taking these certain scientists. There are thousands of others out there that are saying this is false. There are thousands, and I've read and read and read about how there are many, many, many people out there saying this is
bullshit.
Where
have you read that?
But you're looking at all over the internet, all over the news, all over everything. Are you serious? You need to do more research into this whole thing. Are you kidding me? Like, where are you reading this? Are you reading it from Obama? Did Obama tell you this? Did Al Gore tell you this?
Yes,
you know, is that what's going on here?
They're in my green room right now.
Do you drive an electric car?
Hold on. Wait a second. Good.
Just to make clear to the caller,
who is this?
All pre-reviewed studies support science of global warming. And I would appreciate if you would shut up, because we might need to send some Benghazi black Muslim security detail at you, because you're going to disrupt our ability to make a killing in the solar market. That's what Sam and I are working on. And whatever you do,
all right,
please.
Well,
we'll
talk about something else. You don't believe in global warming. All right, fair enough. What else do you take issue with that I've talked about on this program?
I saw the video with the guy with the light bulbs. I agree with him. Those fucking light bulb laws are retarded. There's no point in that. You know, all people are having to do now is turn on more light bulbs. You know, I just. The whole concept to me is that you can't just really buy whatever fucking light bulb you want. It's kind of weird to me, but that's a side subject. Cars, there's no point to... No. Here, let's ask you this question. I bet you are a firm believer that we need to get rid of coal. We just need to get rid of coal power plants. Like, coal is such an ugly, nasty thing that we need to get rid of. I bet you agree with that, don't you?
Yeah.
Do you realize what runs our power in this country, what the
about
main
35%
like,
of our power is run as a function of coal. Yeah,
I think it's actually more than 35%. I think that's a low number. I think we're over 50% of the country is riding on coal. Right now the government is putting in all these little things where you can't have any new coal plants or coal mining or any of that. Why? Why? We're not there yet. Technology is not ready for us to be bailing on coal yet. We're just going to spend shit tons of more money trying to get off of it when we don't have shit tons of more money. We're already in the debt, $17 trillion, $18 trillion. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, I'm sure you don't even give a shit about that because paper money and we can just print it off. So who fucking cares, right? Like, it's just money, man. Like, go right. Spend it however you want, right? That's the way the government looks at it.
Right.
It's just it's a never-ending pool of money that you can just keep printing
actually,
off.
Actually, it's almost as if the government prints money whenever they feel like it.
Yeah. I mean, that's what they do now. Now, this can't last forever. This is going to crash. It's going to crash eventually.
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
Why is it going to crash? Have you looked at the history of mankind and every single country in history has crashed eventually from doing stupid shit like our government's doing, spending money they don't have and taxing their people to death and making the laws that they're making and doing all
Wait a
these
second.
Things.
You realize crumbling
our economy.
You realize that there is no one in this country paying more taxes than anyone did prior to 1980. There is no cohort in terms of making money is paying less taxes than they did in 80, except for, I suppose, you could argue that the payroll tax is up a couple of points since then.
Wait, say this again about tax.
Our tax rates are at their lowest point.
since you've been alive.
So what? They should be lower. They should be lower than they are right now. You are taxing people who are running the country. It's. Have you ever been paid by a poor person? Do you get your paycheck by a homeless man? No,
actually,
you
know what? You know what?
I
mean, I'm the wrong person to ask, but yes, most of the people I think who are members of the show and actually create my paycheck are not in the above $250,000
income. Well, technically, then, if you're your own boss, and you need to worry about the people who listen to your show through the internet and things that they need to pay for, but if they keep paying their ass out of taxes, they're going to stop listening to your shit because they don't have time for it. You know, you're just another person in this world with a show. And this is people that you're a luxury to people because they can sit around and listen to a radio or a TV or something like that.
Entrepreneur value.
Yeah, creator. How dare you? Are you an entrepreneur, sir?
What?
Are you an entrepreneur, sir?
Am I an entrepreneur? Yes, I am, actually. I own my own business.
Yes? How many people
and
do
I
you
work
employ?
For a business.
Huh? You what?
I employ one other person. Actually,
oh, really?
It's a partner. It's
just
the two
one?
Of us right now.
Well, there are more people working just... here. So I think clearly you got to be careful about who you're talking to and the way you're talking to. I'm a creator.
I'm talking to Sam
I'm a maker.
Sater, and I'm talking to all the... Like, you're not understanding how the economy works when it comes to taxing people. There's no reason for us to be taxing the shit out of our human beings here in this country when they need that money, especially for things that are going to start be costing more, like Obamacare. Everybody's prices jumped. Everybody's prices almost doubled or tripled in how much they're going to be paying.
Do you have any,
and not to mention they're going to be paying all these taxes.
Excuse me. Do you have any experience in the fast food industry, sir?
All right, come on. I don't really know how to argue with what you're saying because you're just spewing all the right-wing nonsense. You're not even making an argument. Is there a specific policy you have a problem with? That we can talk about? You don't like taxation because so you don't think that we should be putting money into infrastructure. What would you cut from what the government does?
I'd cut almost everything but the military and foreign affairs. That's the only thing they need to be there for. That's the only thing they were designed
military and foreign
originally
affairs. So no highways, no food inspections, no highways, no food inspections.
No, the federal government doesn't need to be doing that. That can be a state government
thing.
Well,
let me ask you a question. First off, let's not get into I'm going to leave aside for a moment the sort of some notion that somehow the state is better. But how do you think the state's going to pay for that? How do you think the state is going to pay? You live in the South,
fine.
Right?
All right.
Presumably, Route 95 goes through one of your states, maybe, or some other major interstate highway. How are the states going to pay for that? Are they going to make up money? What are they going to do? Do you think they're just going to raise their taxes on you?
State taxing their people.
Oh,
I'm fine with the state.
So you don't have a problem
I'm
with
not
what
okay with
okay,
the federal
okay, hold on.
Government.
Okay, all right.
Taxing.
Now we're getting somewhere, James. Now, so you don't have a problem with taxation. You don't care if the state taxes you up to 95% of your income. It's just
no,
you have
I
a problem
said
with
that.
Federal
Whoa, hold
government.
On here. No. I just have a problem with the federal government taxing on top of the state taxing us, on top of the city taxing us.
Well,
okay?
Why?
There's no reason for that. There's no reason for the federal government. The state government can tax us, and the state government can pay the federal government for their services in the military
well,
and their
so
foreign
you
affairs.
Are, so
That's
in other words, I... you reject the founders of this country. Who set this country up?
No,
as...
I am for the founders of this country.
Excuse me.
Because that's
excuse
what they originally
me.
Set up.
I got news for you, Chief. You are anti-constitutional. Let's face it. Constitution
what?
Provides the federal
you
government
are.
With the right.
No.
No, you are, sir.
All right. How? What? You're telling me that the original founding fathers wanted the federal government to be doing all of this? You're right. They totally set up income tax. They totally did that. They
well, they
that.
Set up
they
a
totally
constitution
up a
and an
they
amendment process, an amendment process. And over 100 years ago, we adopted a federal income tax.
Over 100 years ago, 200
prior
years
to that,
ago, over
prior to that,
ago,
sir, prior to that, the federal government would tax things like alcohol to raise money.
That's
the federal government
did. That's a drug. And that if you're going to be legalized and it can be regulated in tax, just like marijuana or any other drug out there.
Well, wait a second. So you don't have a problem with the federal government taxing. You have a problem taxing income.
Well, I have a huge problem. Income tax, I'd say, is my biggest problem in the tax realm. I'm okay with taxing certain things.
See, James, you could have saved us a lot of valuable minutes by starting out with what is really the problem. So so next time you call in, we'll be able to start from the starting point. You have a problem not with taxes, but with federal taxes, and not federal taxes on goods, but simply on income.
Yeah, no, I have a problem with federal taxes on goods. There's no reason for that. I don't know why they need to have any tariffs or anything on exports or imports that are coming in. There's no reason for that. Let the states do all of this stuff for themselves. If they decide the state wants to do it, then let them do it. That's how the country was designed. And you need to understand how the founding fathers originally set this country up.
So let me ask you this.
Understand.
If the states want to legalize, slavery, just to bring this full circle, are you okay with that?
No, I'm not okay with that, because a libertarian believes that you own your own property and you own your own body. Your body is a part of your property. You cannot slave anybody. It does not work that way. You cannot enslave anybody.
Okay, so you believe in just the ultimate property rights. Is that it? That's the foundation of what you're talking about.
Absolutely. That's the way the Bill of Rights should have originally said it. That's the way they did say it.
Wait, they should have said it?
Property and everything.
They should have said it, or they did say it? Property is the only right that is guaranteed, right? The ultimate right of property, that's it.
It should be, but it's not. You don't own your own property.
That's right.
If you own a house,
do you have a problem with the Constitution or not? Sounds like you do. Sounds like you want to amend the Constitution where property is the only right that people should have.
No, I didn't say that's my only right. What? I never said that was the only right. I said that that is a right, though. You have a right to your property, and that you deserve it, and that you should not be taxed on it or have to pay a lease on it. That's really what you're doing.
Do you have a problem with the state government or the federal government saying, in your property, in your restaurant, you can discriminate against anybody from any race that you want because it's your property?
Yeah, sure. If you want to not feed a white person because they're white, then go ahead, man. If that's
believe me, I do it every day.
That's what you want to do. It's your property.
So, all right. So, fair enough.
Don't eat in front of me, white devil.
You have no problem. So, you have a problem with the Civil Rights Act?
Is there a problem with that? Like, can people not do that? If you come onto someone's, if you go into someone's house, do you expect them to just do whatever you want? No. If they kick you out of their house, they kick you out of their house. It's their property, The same right that you have if someone walks into your house and you don't want them there.
Well, I'm not talking about a house. I'm talking about a restaurant.
A private business?
Yeah.
A business that...
So you got a problem with the Civil Rights Act?
With the Civil Rights Act?
Yeah.
No, I don't have a problem with that. Everybody deserves to be free in this world. Everybody.
You don't even know what the 1965 Civil Rights Act is. Like you're not aware of the fact that that outlawed segregation, right?
Yes, I understand that it outlawed that. I get that. Now, I understand, you know what you're doing right now. You're trying to pinpoint one little thing. You're trying to attack it and make me say it. I get what you're trying to do, and it's
really
idiotic.
Tell me more specifically what I'm trying to do.
Hold on. If a business wants to do whatever they want to do, that's fine, but they won't last very long if they have that mentality. They will not last.
Well, then why were there businesses that were doing well in 1965 that had to have that law imposed upon them?
Yeah, well, there's tons of laws that are just retarded because people think they're smarter than everybody else and they know how to fix the issue. Hmm. Okay, that's not going to – I understand that we can't enslave them. We shouldn't have separate bathrooms. We shouldn't have separate water holes and all that. Like all that shit's stupid. Come on. They can sit wherever they want on a bus, man. Like, let them sit wherever they want. But if you want to walk into a restaurant, it doesn't have to be a black person, man. It can be anybody. If you want to walk into a restaurant and they don't want to fucking serve you, then they don't serve you. It's as simple as that.
They can do it based on color. They can do it based on color.
in your mind?
It can be based on whatever they want it to be based on, man. It's whatever they want. It's not going to be a smart business model, but if that's what they want to do, that's their business.
I'm not
business,
sure. So
the way
sure,
it
James.
Work.
I get the feeling that maybe a restaurant like that could do rather well in maybe in your community.
I'd rather what?
I'm not convinced that a restaurant like that wouldn't do rather well in your community. But look, this has been edifying. I appreciate the phone call.
You're such a southern racist. You're such a, you know, you're such a Yankee.
You know
up there.
What?
You have no idea. Have you
no
ever been to
southerners
the South?
Allowed on this program. My private business.
Oh man.
I'm a southern racist. You know those, all those.
We know about those
southern race.
Southern racist.
Oh
Jews
God, we're all backed up now.